Welcome to Tim Topham TV, the piano teaching podcast. This is episode 56. Well, g'day and welcome back, everyone. I hope you're doing well today, and I've got a great episode for you in our first of our new monthly theme this month, which is all about special needs teaching. And today's guest, Scott Price, many of you will be familiar with. He has a huge amount of experience in this area, and we're going to tap into all of that in just a moment. Before we get started, I do want to thank today's sponsor, which is NovaScore. Now, many of you will have heard of me talking about NovaScore, particularly if you've been to any of my live events. These guys are an online sheet music resource, but it's not the kind that you're thinking about. And so I really want you to pop over today and check them out, novascore.com, or head to today's show notes at timtopham.com/episode56. The reason I really like these guys, and I'm really happy for them to sponsor, is that they have online arrangements of their pieces, up to four adaptations of a whole variety of music in different styles: classical, recent hits, pop, jazz, blues, gospel, movie soundtracks, Christmas, songs for children, all different kinds of music, and you get up to four arrangements. So the great thing here is that if you've got a student who really wants to play a particular song, but you can't find an easy arrangement, jump onto NovaScore and see what they've got, because they have a huge catalog and it's all written by their in-house pianists. So they know it. It's not just some kind of computerized printout or anything like that. You can view the music on any device: computer, laptop, tablet, smartphone, and you can print from any computer or laptop as well when you purchase them. And NovaScore are offering 30% off all their piano sheet music for Tim Topham members, customers, I should say, readers, viewers, you guys out there, during September. So make sure you head to the show notes page to find out your coupon and find out a little bit more about NovaScore. So today's episode, as I said, is all about our introduction to special needs teaching. And I've chosen this as a theme because we've had a lot of people ask me questions about this. I get asked lots about autism spectrum disorder, ADHD children. What do you do? How do you engage them? How do you keep them motivated? How do you keep them, firing and inspired when sometimes their behavior can be really challenging? So I thought, let's go straight to the best in the business and grab Scott Price. Now, Scott Price currently serves as Professor of Piano and Piano Pedagogy at the University of South Carolina School of Music. He's a graduate of the University of Oklahoma. He's got a Doctor of Musical Arts, Cleveland Institute of Music, Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He's a creator and editor-in-chief of the online piano pedagogy journal, Piano Pedagogy Forum. And he's nationally, in fact, I'd say now internationally, recognized as a leader in teaching piano to students with autism and other special needs. He serves as president of the Board of Trustees for the Francis Clark Center for Keyboard Pedagogy. They're the guys that run the NCKP conference, which I'm a big fan of. And he's a 2009 Music Teachers National Association Foundation Fellow. He has nearly two decades experience teaching students with varying levels of autism, visual impairments, hearing impairments, ADD, ADHD, Down syndrome, and other developmental delays. And in today's interview, he really just goes to the bare bones of what special needs teaching is all about. And just after our interview, he actually emailed me a quote, which I really love and I wanted to share with you. It's from an adult student of Scott's who happens to have Down syndrome. In a speech she gave about her experience with music, she said about teaching, "I'm not asking for easy, I'm just asking for possible." That's all our students want, right? It's a chance to learn and excel. And that's what we're going to dive into today in our interview with Scott. Just before we go to that, I did want to mention show notes for today's episode at timtopham.com/episode56. And a quick reminder too, if you're in Australia and you're interested in seeing me live presenting some one-day workshops, then you need to check out my Transform Your Piano Teaching workshop days. I'm running them in conjunction with the fantastic Paul Myatt of Forte Music Schools. And you can find out all about those one-day events, where to get tickets, and we've got an early bird special on right now, so I would grab them while you can. The best thing about these events, the thing I'm most excited about, is that everyone gets to sit at a digital piano for the event. So we're going to be grooving, exploring, improvising, having a great time together on the digital pianos. So to find out more about those live events, head to timtopham.com slash Transform. And I'll make sure I'll check out for you when your enrollment comes through. All right, I think it's time to get on with our interview. Here is Scott Price. All right, Scott Price, welcome to the show today.
Well, thank you, Tim. I think you're doing a great service for piano teachers. I'm just so very happy that you invited me to be with you today.
Well, it means a lot to hear someone as expert and as well-known as you say that. I really do appreciate it. And today we're getting stuck into this concept of special needs teaching, and we're going to talk a little bit about what that actually means shortly. But I thought first up, what's your day-to-day teaching look like at the moment? Are you in universities or private studios? How does it look?
Well, sure. I teach at the University of South Carolina. So I teach graduate performance majors, as well as some of the graduate piano pedagogy courses, and of course, directing graduate research. And then the best part of my day, or one of the best parts of my day, is I shouldn't let my college students say that. One of the wonderful parts of my day is in the afternoons when all of my students with special needs come in, and then I get to spend 2 or 3 hours with all of them about 4 days a week. So it's really a lot of fun.
And they're all young children, or do they completely range in age?
Well, they completely range in age. I have a program here called the Carolina Life Song Initiative, and we provide music experiences for students with special needs. Most of my students are on the autism spectrum, but we've also had students with visual impairments, ADD, ADHD, let's see, Down syndrome, all over the autism spectrum, I think I said. And we also had a doctoral student once who actually had come back to graduate study after running a successful private studio, and she actually started to go deaf while she was an undergraduate performance major.
Oh my goodness.
While being deaf, including all of the performance requirements.
Wow, what an experience. Well, look, I'm so glad to speak to you because you're, as I say, you're an expert, an absolute expert in this area, and particularly in autism spectrum. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Sure. How did you come to become known as a specialist in this field?
Well, I don't know that any of us ever really become a specialist. You know, it's an ongoing process, but it literally is just a phone call. You know, about, it was almost 20 years ago now, I got a call from the local Yamaha dealer in town at the time. His name was Dan Hanflin, wonderful guy. And he had a young family who had come in looking for a piano for their daughter. They didn't even know if they could afford one at that time. And he said, well, just ask them, well, what does she play? And they tell the story as they were like, how do we answer this question? And it turned out that their daughter had been born 4 months premature, was blind from birth, extremely low functioning on the autism spectrum, developmental delays, which meant that she needed help feeding and, you know, dressing. But it turned out that she could literally, if she listened to a CD by like Elton John or somebody like that, or Whitney Houston or Mariah Carey, she could then play back all of the songs in simplified arrangements on the piano after one pass.
Wow.
And so I said, you know, sure, we're here. I'd love to meet her. And so she came in, and I was understandably humbled by her gifts. And so we went from there, and the parents network, unfortunately, at that time, things have gotten a lot better. But at that time, often what they would hear is, I don't know how to teach this child. I don't think I could help her. I don't want to do the wrong thing. So they would hear no a lot. And so we just, parents network, and one student turns into two, turns into three, turns into four, and before you know it, here we are 20 years later.
Wow. Now, is that student you were talking about the one that I found some information about on the web? You were interviewed. Was her name Brittany? Or was that a different student? Yeah, yeah. So I did some digging on you, Scott, so I always do with my guests. It was interesting to read. That was literally about 20 years ago, I guess. I'm interested to know, you know, for teaching someone like this, who was blind and, you know, autistic and severe developmental delays, how do you actually approach that? And it sounds like you're actually pretty new to it yourself when you started. What did you try out when you first started?
Well, you know, I guess unlike all piano teachers, you know, you're there for your students, and whatever they need, you try. you know, try to help them the most that you can. In this case, Brittany was later considered to be a prodigious savant, which what that means is it's someone whose gifts and ability are as extraordinary as their disabilities are limiting. And so here's a young lady who had perfect pitch, could play back everything that you played to her on the piano, and then was later found to be able to improvise and compose. The only thing that she really didn't have was that she had never seen anyone play the piano. So she literally was playing everything with the third finger of each hand and right. finding her way around the keyboard. So our biggest job was to help her learn to use all the fingers on her hands in different combinations and to develop her technical ability.
And I assume you'd probably do that with a lot of touch for a student like that. You'd be showing her physically on the keyboard.
A lot of hand over hand type yeah. thing. And with a student like Brittany, she had literally such a limited vocabulary that you have to teach her what these words that we use actually mean. So you can't say, well, let your arm float. It has no meaning to her. So it's tense and tight, relax. And then lots of her touching my arm and feeling what tense and tight is and what relaxed is and feeling what a good hand position is and things like that.
Goodness me, it must take a lot of patience because I imagine it would be a slow process.
Well, a lot of people say that to me. And interestingly, my answer is always there's no patience about it because during the lesson, it's a whirlwind of thinking and evaluating and readjusting and managing behaviors and thinking, what am I going to do next? How are we going to handle this problem? So actually, the minute they walk out of the door, you get a chance to just relax and take a deep breath because yeah. you've been on this roller coaster of music making yeah. for half an hour.
And do you have to sometimes give yourself permission to have a really bad lesson where actually nothing really happens with students like this sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. And I have colleagues who say you just have to get over it. There are days when the student leaves and you think, I did everything wrong. I was a horrible teacher today. But probably not, because you were spending time with them and they were listening. And so whatever they received from you is going on in their mind, and it will come back to you the next week.
And let's face it, we can feel like that with any student on any day, really, can't we? Now, in 2006, I found an article in Chicago Tribune where you were quoted as saying, this concept of teaching special needs students, this is a brand new thing in the piano teaching field. Piano teaching in this country has really been about playing for a hobby or preparing for the next competition. Nobody ever thought that this group could play. Now we're discovering that they can and that they do it really well. So 10 years on, have things changed a little bit more now?
Yes, they have, and wonderfully so. You know, of course, piano teaching is more than just hobby playing and more than just preparing for a competition. It's a lot of personal development, growth, and enjoyment. But, you know, you didn't see a lot of students with special needs in the studios. And, you know, laws have changed in different countries around the world. And, you know, parents they're out there advocating and actively looking for the same experiences for their children as for any other child. And so when I used to give my first workshops, I would just ask the audience, you know, please raise your hand if you have a student with special needs, and maybe two hands would go up. Now you ask the question and more than half of the hands in the room will go up. And that's just such a gratifying thing to see. It's just just a real tribute to everyone out there who's teaching that you take on the challenge.
What do you come to understand by the meaning of special needs?
Of course, on the surface, special needs, meaning anybody who has a disability or a diagnosis, who needs a little bit of different treatment within the lesson. But I think now, for me, it means not only that, but also I'm going to have to change my traditional teaching approach. And that can mean not being able to teach with vocabulary for one student. Maybe it's just tone of voice for that student. Maybe a student can't see my body language or can't see how my hand is playing. So we have to completely change the approach to teaching technique. Or like my student who was deaf, things like you can't play and talk at the same time. She specifically one day said, look at me when you talk and please don't play when you talk because you know I can't hear you and I have to read your lips.
Got it.
Just things I would not have ever thought of. And of course, you have to kind of put aside your ego and not be shocked that a student told you to be quiet and to look at them.
I would imagine for many teachers, and I would be in the same, just knowing that you couldn't talk or that talking wasn't the best approach, you know, it would be a real frustration for many people.
Yeah, it can be, but you know, we're there for our students and we do whatever we need to.
So what kind of outcomes have you seen for students? We've talked about Brittany, obviously perhaps she was a little bit of a special case with being a savant. What about for other students? What kind of outcomes have you seen that sticking to piano lessons for these students can bring?
Well, just in general, all of my students play on recitals every semester. And in addition to the repertoire, I teach a lot of improvisation here at the university and all of my students. And so they are all required to improvise for the audience during the recitals. So Fantastic. Once they're finished, I just say, time to improvise, and they just go ahead and play. Or some of them compose and they play their own compositions. So they have the same outcomes as any other student. They can play just as expressively, and then they can do all the creative things as well.
Yep.
Other outcomes, it's amazing when you see a student with autism who's maybe minimally verbal turn around and make eye contact with you and start trying to talk to you about their music making and about their playing or about something that you played. Or a student who, one of my students who has trouble tying his karate belt because he has motor planning issues and he can't do things that cross hands, playing improvisation and cross hands in every single bar with no problem. So there are a lot of important outcomes and things that the lesson does for a student, which is not necessarily just the music making. There's a social link to it, communication and other things.
I gather that would probably be the case, and that music can somehow get through barriers where other things don't. And suddenly a student can change or look at you. I think that would just be, it would be such an amazing experience as a teacher.
Well, if I could just share another story. Years ago, I did a session with another Canadian piano teacher on a student of hers who had Tourette's syndrome. And the boy was 15 years old at the time. He gave up and gave a wonderful speech about how what the piano had done for him. And he said, before I started studying piano, I didn't have any friends because of my Tourette's syndrome and all of the physical and vocal tics that I had. But when people see me play the piano, they want to be my friend and they want to talk to me now.
That's great, isn't it? All right, so let's start talking about some approaches for teachers, because I know there's going to be a lot of teachers watching and listening who perhaps have students in their studio like this or who are interested in expanding to offer these kind of lessons. And perhaps they've even had students come to them for a first lesson or an interview and they've just, you know, gone a bit, I don't know if I can do this sort of thing. So let's say a teacher is approached by the parent of a special needs child. Have you got some questions they should be asking, some things they should be doing in that first interview or that first lesson to get a gauge on whether they could do it?
As far as feeling like, what do I do? Well, join the club. We're all in that with every single student who comes along because they're all different and they all have different needs, and we have to change our teaching approach. So don't be worried about that. You're in the same club. Usually when a student comes to me, they specifically come to me because they know I teach primarily students who are mid to lower functioning on the autism spectrum. So often the parents will volunteer almost all of the information that you need. All you have to do is say, tell me about your son or tell me about your daughter, and they will give you very specific information about those students. If that's not quite forthcoming, and there can be many reasons for that, all you have to do is usually say something about, is there anything that you can tell me that I might need to know to serve your child better or to help make the lessons more effective and beneficial for them? And that helps open up the conversation if the parents are a little reticent as they come.
And what about with the child themselves? perhaps if you haven't experienced a low functioning, we should actually let's talk about these terms for a second. Let's just talk autism spectrum disorder. Can you just give us the rundown of what the different functionings mean?
For sure. If I can just first throw out that you'll hear me saying a lot of things like student with autism or student with a hearing impairment. It's what we call person first language, which a lot of the parents will request or actually demand, because if you say that deaf kid or that blind kid, the focus is on the disability and not on the actual person. So they prefer that we say person with. Now, on the other side of that coin, some people will come in and actually say, I am autistic. I am an autistic person. Please call me, you know, I'm autistic. And that's fine. We just go with the request. So back to your question about autism. Autism is a spectrum disorder, meaning on one end of the spectrum, you might not know that someone has impairments in social behavior or social communication. On the other end of the spectrum, we have what we call somebody who's low functioning, who, like Brittany, may have a very limited vocabulary, may have very limited cognitive ability, may need help dressing, and may need help feeding, and 24/7 care, and may have limited ability to do most of the things that you and I take for granted every day. So that's basically what the spectrum is, and then what these words low functioning and high functioning mean.
And while we're on that topic, is Asperger's considered part of the autism spectrum, or is that a separate thing?
Well, that's an interesting question. Asperger's was considered part of the autism spectrum, but when the new manual of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders came out, that somewhat changed. Okay. On the fifth edition, we had autism spectrum disorder. We had Asperger's syndrome, which is similar to autism, except there are not a lot of the communication deficits that there are with standard autism. And then there was also something called PDD-NOS, which was pervasive developmental delay, not otherwise specified, which basically meant that you had some of the characteristics for autism, but basically couldn't get a full diagnosis.
Okay.
So when the new version of the manual came out, now there's just autism spectrum disorder, but there are different levels of autism in there.
Okay.
We'll have a lot of people still be having, still say, I have Asperger's syndrome. That's fine.
Okay. But so that would, if otherwise that would be classified as high functioning on the autism spectrum. Is that right? Kind of. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. We should get our language right, I guess.
Talk, but I think it's important for people to know how something has changed and all of these issues that might come up in an interview.
It looked like you were pointing to a book. Is there a book there on that topic?
On
the topic of disorders, it looks like you were looking over there. Is there a big reference manual?
It's called the DSM, the Diagnostical Manual of, I always have to look it up, Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So that's where all of the people who diagnose any kind of mental disorder, they go, and this is the standard manual that gives you all of the guidelines by which you would diagnose it. And it should be a team of professionals. We're really, as piano teachers, shouldn't be diagnosing those things. And, you know, if you're in an online group somewhere and people are diagnosing these, it really should be a team of professionals.
Now, let's say if you're having your first lesson with an autistic student, and perhaps they're reasonably low functioning and non-verbal. I understand every student's going to be very different, but are there some tactics that generally work, or some tricks that you've learned over the years that can help?
Yeah, you learn a lot of tricks because I ended up doing everything wrong. And, you know, of course, sometimes that's the best way to learn. You end up doing the right things by doing all the wrong things. Well, just because a student is non-verbal, that just means they're not speaking to you. It doesn't mean they aren't hearing everything and comprehending a lot of things. So usually one of the big things is a lot of students with autism have a lot of hypersensitivity issues. They're overstimulated by many things in the environment that just, you know, wouldn't bother you or I. Things like fluorescent lights and all the flickering, What to you and I would just seem like, you know, a small spritz of cologne could be like an open bottle to them. Or some fabrics are just too confining or too irritating to their skin. So oftentimes I try to eliminate those things from my studio, if at all possible, all of those sensory distractions. So when they come in, I think one of the most important things that I first do is just say hello. I'm glad to see you. Because how many times does this person with special needs hear, hello, I'm glad to see you, how are you today?
Mm.
So I think it's just human nature to assume, oh, they just don't understand us. So that's the first thing I do. And it's also designed to manage behaviors. So oftentimes they're trying to gauge their new environment. And so I will pretty explicitly say those things, then say, can you sit in the chair, please? And can you sit quietly while I talk to your mother or your father? And just so they realize they're starting to learn these social behaviors that they bring into the lesson. So that's often a start.
Mm. There's no reason why you shouldn't be setting perhaps the usual expectations of these students up front. It's just to see what happens determines where you go.
They have the same expectations as far as behavior and musical achievement, but because their autism includes an impairment of social behaviors, you know, things that you and I take for granted, like a student knows how to stand outside the door quietly and wait for a lesson, or they know guidelines for personal space, or certain things that you can say, certain things that you don't say. You know, somebody's age, we automatically understand that there are certain ways to address them and certain respect. People with autism sometimes can't read those unspoken social behaviors. And so they're learning those as they go along. They may not understand them sometimes, but they just learn this is what I need to do in this situation. So you're teaching those things as well.
And the parents are going to be really helpful, obviously, in knowing perhaps that a student, you know, really needs a darker room or a lighter room, or that you don't wear funky colognes or things like that. That's hopefully that the parents will know those things already, I would assume, when the student comes in.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. They are your best line of defense. They know that child inside and out. They're with them 24/7, so they can help you with certain things to say or not say in the lesson. And depending upon the day, you never know what might have happened. There might be certain things you might start doing that might be triggers for upsets or shutdowns or things, and the parent might get your attention and just say, no, don't, or contact you and say, today we shouldn't do this. There was a rough day at school. And so you don't do that.
Mm. And so you've got to be really open to learning, don't you, as a teacher? You're going to be learning a lot as you go.
I have one student who, one of his triggers is if you look at him and you go, shh. And of course, what do all the kids do at school? Because they know that will set him off.
Oh.
And so that's bullying that he gets. And she was very surprised that I did that one day and he didn't react. And I think it was because he was so focused on his lesson. But I have my file for the student, and at the top of the list or near the top of the list, it will say, don't say, shh.
If we're going to
talk about dynamics, it's quiet.
Yes. Okay. So you've given away a little bit of a secret there about how you manage to keep track of your students. So what? Tell us about the file that you have on each student, because this would obviously be quite important if you've got a number of these students.
Well, what works really well in my class for my students with autism is a routine or a schedule. And I like to call these, when I'm teaching the graduate students, a macro routine and a micro routine. And the macro routine is often something the parents that are doing at home, they'll say something like, and this is a real routine that they used to use, something like, you know, today is Monday, you're going to go to school, then you'll come home, you'll practice piano, we'll have dinner, then you'll do homework. Same thing on Tuesday, same thing on Wednesday, except for Thursday. After Thursday, mommy will come get you in the car and we'll go see Scott for piano. And that's so they always know what is coming next. That alleviates a lot of the upset in their daily lives. So when they come in for a lesson, I'll often say, you know, hello, how are you? Today, we are going to do five finger patterns. We are going to do lesson book, performance book, theory. Then we'll improvise and whatever else is there for the lesson that day. So they always know what is coming next. And that takes care of a lot of the behaviors.
Right.
Now, if you think, I don't have time to do that, what happens if I forget something? The autistic mind is like a steel trap. If you forget or you didn't have time to write it out, just look at this student and say, what's next? I'll tell you.
It's a good approach for teaching generally, I think, saying up front what students are going to learn and things. Does keeping the same order in every lesson, that does help too, rather than just saying at the start of the lesson, this is what's going to happen, but actually keeping that consistent each week?
Yeah, I think that exact word you used, consistency, is very, very important. And then once that routine is established, you can start to change little things in there, and they get used to that change, and it's not as much of an upset. Now, within the micro routine, students with autism, they work very, very well with step-by-step instructions. A lot of times you'll read things about applied behavioral analysis or directed trial teaching, which in a nutshell is just breaking things down in the step-by-step directions they need to learn to execute a task. So, and this is a real example too. It's not just something I'm making up. If a typical average student is learning to play the two black keys on the piano, often we might teach that just by saying, look at the group of black keys. How many do you see? Can you find the group of two? Can you take the two longest fingers on your hand and play those? Or just give it a model yourself. Now, I just assume that a student has a vocabulary, that they know their colors, that they know their finger numbers, and that they know their numbers and can find groupings on the keyboard. So with a student who's very low functioning and nonverbal, I actually had to work with this system, which is, this is your hand, this is your right hand, this is your finger number two, this is the piano, this is a black piano key. Can you take your finger number two, push the black piano key down? That's great. You just played a black piano key with your finger number two on the right hand. Can you do it again? Now, if you do it that way, it is locked in and they know it.
So it's really about a matter of just being very precise with the language you use too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Concrete, literal language.
Yeah.
And the way we traditionally teach piano, which involves a lot of metaphors and things, it can go horribly wrong.
I could just imagine. So you talked just before about, did you use the word macro and micro goals?
Yeah,
goals
and micro routine.
Routine, okay. So the macro one is the whole student's life, daily life, and what they're doing each day.
And then the micro routine, the step-by-step for the lesson, and then also the step-by-step teaching for each element. And sometimes that can be one measure of music or two measures of music.
And what about practice for these students? I imagine they would need, to have some real success, they would need a very conscientious parent helping them at home to practice. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair comment. And sometimes they will have a therapist who visit the house as well, who will sit with them while they practice to make sure they're doing it. And I'm fortunate that I have a wonderful colleague here in town who's really a brilliant music therapist who works with some of the students as well on some of their concepts. But I use a five-step plan with all of them when they're learning their music. And most of them can recite this back. The first is they have to learn their notes. Then they have to do fingerings. Then they have to do counting. And then they have to break down the piece into small, manageable bits. And that could be just right hand for one measure or half a measure, whatever it takes to get that done. And then they have to do it five times correctly before they can move on. And, you know, most students will just roll their eyes at you and say, five times correctly, are you kidding? But the students with autism love the repetition and the routine, and they think this is the funnest game, to get it five times. They'll actually look at me and watch me hold up another finger.
Mm. So parents, in the first interview, if you're going to take on a student with some of these needs, you would need to make sure the parent realizes that they're going to have to work with their child at home on the practice quite carefully, right?
Oh yeah, we have a lot of talks about that. Emails are exchanged, and you know, if the parent is not a musician, hasn't taken lessons, one of the best tools I have is my iPhone, and so I'll just take movies of some things and send them by email. Or a lot of times, I'll hear the parent walk up behind me, and they've got their iPad, and they start taking video of portions of the lesson that they need, and that's fine. We just have an agreement that it doesn't go up on Facebook or YouTube.
Great. Is there any time you haven't taken on a student? Perhaps the requirements have been too difficult, or I don't know, the parents have been too pushy, or I don't know what it is, but is there any time you've just said, look, I'm not sure this is going to work. I'm not sure I can do this?
I always try my best to give it a go, and I make it very clear to the parents at the first lesson that we will give this a try. If for some reason after a few weeks you feel like it isn't working well, I will try and find a referral from you or for you. If I feel like it isn't working well, or I'm not the right person for your child, I will try to find somebody else for you, and we'll all be friends. And they're perfectly happy to give it a try. They just want a chance. That's all they want.
We've talked a little bit about lower functioning autism spectrum students. What about for the higher functioning students who you might not even know, as you said before, that they're on the spectrum. Sorry, that might not be the right terminology. They're on the autism spectrum. What about those students? Is your teaching approach perhaps more, should we say, normal, like for a usual student, and then you just find there's perhaps just a few little things that you can tweak to suit that student?
Yeah, usually it is in the use of vocabulary, and maybe I won't use as many metaphors. Things like instead of saying something like, "Well, your arm needs to float like a cloud as you play this Debussy piece," I might have to actually say, "Keep your hand above the keyboard. Use a slower key descent." So be very literal and specific, and maybe put more structure in the learning and the practice environment. I want to hear the first movement of the sonatina next week, and I want you to work on X, Y, and Z specifically. So maybe just being a little bit more specific.
Great. Now I've got to read. Sorry, go on.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I think it's important if there's somebody on the autism spectrum, just give a little bit more laxity in the social niceties. Because oftentimes they can't read social situations, or oftentimes they don't understand that there are certain things that you don't draw attention to, or certain things that you don't say. So if let's say your hair is a little messy that day, and somebody is very close to you staring intently at your hair, don't take it personally, because actually your hair might be messy that day. They just noticed it and kind of fixated on that. So just. Or if somebody doesn't address you in what you might consider the most polite way, they're not trying to be mean. It's just part of the package that comes.
My experience with more high functioning students is, or one of them is, that I could tell with this particular student very quickly how he was feeling that day, and you'd get a very quick sense of perhaps some agitation or something. You know, maybe he'd come out of class, or that day at school, something had happened, and I could sense it very quickly. And I learned very quickly to adjust my teaching style to suit, because the first time I started getting frustrated because he wasn't doing something, and bang, you know, things blew up. So I could learn to get a read on this student, and then perhaps give him a bit more latitude, or not get so frustrated, or just be more positive, whatever it was.
Sure. And I think when you said give a little latitude, I think that's very important in lessons. That sometimes that extra few minutes just to process something is very, very necessary. Or just those few extra minutes to chat a little bit at the lesson to help the student get acclimated to their surroundings, to decompress from, you know, walking in the building with all the people or whatever has gone on during the day. Just that extra time to acclimate and just the extra time to process. Doesn't mean you're a bad teacher if you're just sitting back for 2 minutes and not saying anything. You're actually giving them time to do what they need to
I've got a reader question, Scott. It's actually about ADHD. So we haven't talked so much about that, but perhaps you can help. One of my readers says, just after your thoughts on something, I've got a little boy, 7 years old, ADHD inattentive. Would you recommend he do better in a short private piano lesson or a group? This kid has been in a shared private with another boy for 18 months and it has been counterproductive at best. I'm about to separate them. The other boy is fine and I'm not sure what to do about this one. Thinking maybe 20 minutes on the piano, a game, some note reading, and then 10 minutes on some drums. He rolls around on the floor and stares out the window most of the time, but does practice ad hoc. Can you help with that one?
Well, I might be able to give some general suggestions for things with these types of students. You know, I don't know that student or that particular situation. But often, you know, a student with ADD or ADHD or even a student with autism, sometimes they need a break from the intensity of the situation. So if a student needs to sit on the floor and play with some worry beads or squeeze, you know, a tennis ball or something, fine. They'll come right back and be more focused for the lesson. A lot of times with a student with ADD or ADHD, I need to close up the piano because you know how most students, if they see the hammers and the dampers start going, it's over.
All right.
So often we close up the piano and remove that kind of distraction. Or so moving back and forth very quickly between things can be helpful sometimes.
Yeah, so short. So on the bench, off the bench, just mixing up a variety of things.
And then constant redirection too. Some students that I've had, you know, if they make a mistake, they'll want to go back to the beginning of the piece. So often my hand is covering up what they've seen so they can't go back. Or we're constantly talking to them and directing them forward. It's a process that I call teaching in the process, which is very distracting for an average student to have you talking at them constantly while they play. But for a student with autism or another special need, you're actually heading off mistakes before they happen, and you're actually directing them to things they need to concentrate as they go ahead. And so I found that to be very, very helpful.
Great. Okay, so I was interested. You've mentioned that all your students improvise, and not only do they improvise, they do it on stage in front of a crowd, which I think is fantastic. You know, I'm very, very pro improvising and teaching students to be creative. Can you give us a quick little intro to your approach to teaching a bit of improv with these students?
Sure. Actually, I teach a graduate seminar in the pedagogy of improvisation where we go through how to teach it from beginning to advanced levels, but all the students have to improvise in every class, and we kind of go, there are free improvisation activities, but they have to go through all of music history and learn to improvise in all the forms as we go through. And so it was actually my students with autism that created that course, and so I just kind of made the graduate pedagogy students do it. But it basically, I'll start with a lot of five-finger patterns for the students and with concrete literal language. And we do a lot of my turn, your turn. They're learning behaviors such as you have to sit and listen to the model, then you have to do something similar. So they usually, that's how they learn steps and skips and how to create a melody within a five-finger pattern. And that comes from music learning theory where a lot of verbal instruction and labels should come later in the process, that at first it's an aural and then doing. So we do a lot of that together. And then I show them how to put a harmonic fifth with a five-finger pattern. And we do, again, my turn, your turn. And then they begin to take over the improvisation and make the piece. And then later it becomes, listen to me. I'm going to do something in contrary motion. Can you do one like that? And then these amazing things start to come out of the students once they have a repertoire of patterns and they've equated those aural patterns with finger movements and black and white keyboard patterns, then extraordinary things start to happen. Mm. And they've done it all their lives, so they don't think it's hard and they don't think it's unusual to sit down and improvise for an audience.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Gordon's techniques. I'm not by no means a specialist, but the reading I've done makes a lot of sense. And so it's great to hear you talk about this and its usefulness in teaching with special needs too. Just, you know, brilliant to make that connection because we actually spent 2 months ago, the whole focus on the blog and the podcast, you might know, was all about Gordon's music learning theory. And it was fascinating hearing a lot of the comments come back about these patterns and how much sense it makes. So it's great to have that reiterated by you. Now, have you got any other final kind of thoughts on teaching approach generally that you've seen work, just to give teachers who are listening a bit of a heads up or a bit of a, you know, a few steps forward in the process before they begin teaching the next student?
Sure. In my own teaching and the success that I think we've had, it all comes down to the structure and the routine and breaking things down into their very basic parts and using concrete and literal language. Like with a lot of my typical average students, I used to like to kind of personify the notes and say, who is that? And because that can lead to creative things like, what is this note doing? You know, like dynamics and expressive capabilities. And I had a young man on the autism spectrum who got very angry with me and said, notes aren't people. And we had a 5-minute chat about the fact that I was very wrong about this. And he's actually correct.
Yeah.
So that concrete literal language is very, very important. And breaking things down into their component parts. And, you know, if something goes wrong in a lesson or there's a blow up or a shutdown, it's not necessarily anything that we did as a teacher. It could have been something that happened last week. It could have been something else that happened during the day that causes that to happen. And as you get to know your students better, you'll learn how to sort of head those things off or avoid them. And then I think also, I like to give my parents a lot of leeway. Sometimes I'll get a phone call 5 minutes into the lesson time saying, we had a bad day at school. I don't think we can come. And that's fine with me. Or, you know, if they're late, like one day I had a student, I get very concerned when they're late because I'm afraid something has happened. And the mother came rushing up. Apparently they stopped for food. She didn't know there was a ketchup packet in the bag, and the boy had decided to paint ketchup all over his clothes. Uh-huh. So they were actually down at the parking meter changing his clothes so that she could bring him for a lesson. So I think a lot of leeway with the parents is important too.
And being really flexible.
Yes, being very flexible.
Do you think teaching students like this makes you a better teacher?
As the young folks say, it kind of rocked my world. when I first started with Brittany and some of the younger or the first students that I had, you know, I'd had a lot of success as a teacher, thought I knew some things and found out very quickly that I really didn't know anything. But it's such a gift. They are really such gifts. It might sound cliche to say that, but every day in the afternoon, I have 2 or 3 people come in who give me a masterclass in teaching. I am the student. I get to learn these marvelous things about connecting with another person and helping them learn how to achieve in music making. They are the ones who give that to me every day. So I have the best job in the world. I really do.
Scott, it's been great teaching. Great speaking with you today. I'm interested to hear just before we finish about the Inclusive Piano Teaching blog. Can you tell us about that, where students, teachers can find it and what it's about?
Well, this is the Inclusive Piano Teaching blog. It's brand new. You can find it on the Francis Clark Center for Keyboard Pedagogy website, which is keyboardpedagogy.org. You'll see a link to blogs on the banner. It's brand new. So right now we're introducing the authors of the blog, who are myself, Elizabeth Bauer from Wheaton College in Illinois, and Melissa Martiros from Martin Methodist College in Tennessee. And what we'll be providing later on are just thoughts about how we can better serve students with special needs. So one of the posts that will be coming up next month is all about person-first language that we talked about. We'll have one coming up on labels. We have plans for the questions that you asked me about how do you handle studio requests and interviews and things like that. So, you know, please stop back to the blog about every 2 weeks or so. We hope to have something new.
Brilliant. That's going to be a great resource for teachers. I know that. Are there any other places?
If you happen to be at the National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy next summer at the end of July, we'll have sessions on teaching students with special needs. And I think we'll also be having some live teaching demonstrations. I know that's a long journey for folks on your side of the world. Love to have you.
Yeah, well, look, as you know, I love going to that and recommend anyone that can possibly get there go. I had such a great time last time, and I know that seeing teaching in action is one of the best things. So to actually see teachers working with special needs students, I think would be fascinating and such a great learning experience.
And I think the wonderful thing about the piano teaching profession is that everybody just jumps in and just really works as hard as they can to help students. And so it really is a grassroots sort of movement with teaching students with special needs. So you find somebody in your community who's doing it, and then you connect. And before you know it, there's an entire group of teachers who are doing this kind of work, and you all become. We need more groups of resources right now. So anybody who's doing the job, I just have a really heartfelt congratulations and thank you. And please throw up a blog or publish an article or something. We need more resources.
That's great. Well, is there anything I've kind of forgotten or skipped over, Scott, that we should have mentioned today, or have we done a pretty good introductory coverage?
Oh, as always, you have great questions, Tim. And just I always make this plea that, not everybody has to have a whole studio full of students with autism or other special needs, but if every single piano teacher in the world can just take one, can you imagine how many people and how many families we serve? Because it's not just one student. The piano lessons are about the entire family. And when you look out at the recital and you see the entire family there, brothers, cousins, and their faces are beaming at what they've seen their child do, because this is maybe the first time they've seen their child do something that every other child can do. It's really about the whole family. So if you can do that for somebody, it's just a great thing.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I know you are going to have got so many other teachers. Well, you're going to have given permission to them to go, it's okay that I don't really know what I'm doing here. We're going to be encouraging some teachers to take on some students, perhaps. So I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Tim. And just everybody, jump in. That's all you have to do.
Great. We'll pop the link to your inclusive piano teaching blog up on the show notes page soon. That'll be great.
All right.
All
Thank you so
right.
much. Thank you.
And I'll look forward to seeing you next year at the NCKP.
Great. Can't wait.
Awesome. See you later, Scott.
Bye.
If the idea of a piano teacher's community where you get to access the best educational resources, rub shoulders with expert teachers from around the world, and have immediate access to feedback for any of your questions, then Inner Circle membership is for you. The Inner Circle is my private community of piano teachers from across the globe who share a commitment to creating and delivering the most inspiring, modern, and progressive learning experiences for their students. Membership is now open, so head to timtopham.com/community to find out more and get involved today. I can't wait to see you on the inside.